how do we break down that cognitive dissonance to say, I can do it myself, we can do it together, and that's where we get into the strategies. So system-wide vision of equitable instruction for all learners, including multilingual learners.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Highest Aspirations, an education podcast focused on providing educators with inspiration and strategies to help multilingual learners and all students achieve their highest aspirations. I'm your host, Steve Sofronis, and you just heard the voice of Sarah Otto, a longtime educator with over 20 years of experience teaching, training, and coaching for English language learner success. She returned to Highest Aspirations to talk with us about creating school-wide systems of improvement for more equitable instruction for all students. As the founder of Confianza and the author of The Language Lens for Content Classrooms, a guide for K-12 educators of English and academic language learners, she has many strategies to share that will help you efficiently apply language instruction in ways that will help all students, including multilingual learners. You can read her full bio on the show notes and in the blog post. Here are some of the essential questions we'll cover in this episode. What role do identity and social location play for educators, and how can we be more intentional about updating the education systems in which we work? How can we implement a school-wide system of support for educators and a culture that encourages collaboration and empathy? What is some advice or a good starting point for educators who feel overwhelmed at the idea of add-on work to successfully support language learners in their classes? As always, you can find a blog post with key takeaways from this Highest Aspirations episode and all others on our EL community page. Just check out elevationeducation.com/ELcommunity for a searchable library of free multimedia resources you can use and share right now. And as I was recording this, I'm wondering if it is the biggest library of EL-related resources. I cannot confirm that, but it is certainly one of them, so check it out. We also invite you to join the conversation and learn from your colleagues around the country by joining the Elevation Educators Facebook group. There you'll find valuable tips from others, as well as the connections you need to help you grow professionally. As always, thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations, and we hope you enjoy this conversation with Sarah Otto from Confianza. Sarah Otto, it is so nice to have you back on Highest Aspirations.
Thanks for having me, Steve. Great to be here again.
Yeah, for sure. You said again, right before we started, I looked, and it was 3 years ago that we were doing the Reimagining EL Education series during COVID, but at a time when we were trying to kind of come out of it. So that's crazy that it was that long ago. It seems like 2 days ago.
It's a little bit of a blur at the same time.
That's true. That's definitely true. But that was a great conversation. We've been sharing a lot of Confianza's work and the work that you're doing on the briefs. So that's been an awesome partnership. And so it just makes complete sense to bring you back and talk a little bit about the new edition of your book. And just as importantly, to kind of bring out some pieces of it, hopefully everybody will read it, but give people kind of a preview and an idea of what you're working on, because I think it's really important stuff. So let me start there. Let me start by asking you about the title. Of the book, which again, you've recently updated in a second edition. What do you mean when you say the language lens? I think that's a really interesting way of approaching it. And I haven't heard that, but maybe that's just me. But on behalf of everybody else, I just wanted to ask that first question.
Sure. You got it, Steve. Yeah. So the first book was called The Language Lens for Content Classrooms, a guide for teachers of English language learners and academic language learners. And the second edition still has the language lens in the title, The Language Lens for Content Classrooms. And the updated subtitle is a guidebook for teachers, coaches, and leaders. And we'll get into that part later. But the language lens is essentially an approach that I developed over my career as a lifelong teacher. And it's really about making what we do more intentional as any teacher, any support staff, any leader, so that we can believe and actually enact practices and mindsets that work for all learners.
Great. Makes sense. And I went through the book and I kind of chose, with your help before guiding, you know, this conversation, I kind of chose some pieces of it to talk about because there's a lot there. I focused on kind of the beginning, the first couple chapters, and that's kind of what we'll get into today. So just to let folks know right off the bat, there is a lot more in there than what we're going to get into today, but hopefully this will give a nice preview and again, some like actionable things that people can take away. Mm-hmm. So really, really early in the book, you make it clear that the guidance you provide is designed for educators of two types of students, one of which we are all, well, we're familiar with both, but these names are really interesting. Multilingual learners, right? We all know multilingual learners, English learners, emergent bilinguals, wherever you are, whatever you're calling them. And then academic language learners, which we probably all know what that means, but I was actually, it was really refreshing for me to hear that term, academic language learners. And listeners of this podcast are really familiar with multilingual learners, but maybe they haven't heard the other one. And I think it's really important to get into it. Talk a little bit about why you intentionally include that term, academic language learners, which is all over the book. Who are they? Aren't they just everyone else? And what can teachers do to best serve those students as well as their multilingual learners?
Yeah, you got it. So really, it's the impetus for the language lens. We talked about that before. It's like, let's start with tier one instruction. Okay, so most of our teachers nationwide are teaching all students in a general education classroom, whatever content they're teaching. So I'm speaking to all of you in the audience. Most of you, I know a lot of you are, you know, really in the MLL, ELL space, but we know that our students who identify as language learners, as multilingual learners, spend most of their day with general educators. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's really the story of my teaching career, having gone from general ed to ESL and bilingual, and then to coaching and leadership and master's programs in ESL and so forth. Now at Confianza, it's all about how can we start with what all students need? So academic language learners are, we start with students who may not identify as multilingual learners, but are learning the language of your physical education class, your biology class, your third grade science class. You know, again, any learning space that students are in, there's language that goes along with that, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's, I guess, like, so it's not hard to understand what that is, but the reason for you to include it in there and be so deliberate about it, I think is really important. You just did a great job explaining it. I feel like sometimes there is a separation, particularly among, and I'll you know, consider myself one as an early teacher of content. You know, I didn't, it was hard for me to make that connection between an academic language learner and a multilingual learner, right? And that seems to be still something that's lingering, although it's definitely getting better, I think, over time, thanks to a lot of the work that you're doing and others are doing in the field as well. Mm-hmm. Another thing that resonated with me sort of right away of the book, and this is kind of as a former teacher myself, I taught high school Spanish for 17 years, and I found myself sort of falling into this, what you talked about here, which is this idea that we teach the way we were taught. And the quote that you have here is, as educators, we are products of the very system, the very systems we are trying to change from within. And that's like so true. I'll tell just a quick sort of story about myself. I mean, when I started teaching, and by the way, I had zero training, so that probably didn't help. I was kind of like thrown into a classroom at just turned 22 years old. I probably had no business. Yes, same. You're pointing the same there. So, you know, I'd like to hear more about that when I'm through here. So sure. It was like middle of the school year. It was a crazy situation that I won't get into now because it's just too long of a story. And my first inclination was, okay, how did my Spanish teachers teach Spanish? Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to disparage my Spanish teachers in high school because some of them were great, but some of them were not. And I think that's largely because of the way that they were taught to teach. And that carried over to me, even though I knew that certain things that they did didn't work for me and it didn't work for others. And I'll tell you, that didn't just last for my first year of teaching. It lasted for a few years until I met people and I had some professional learning and I got more confident to be able to try new things and be innovative. And so it took me a long time to kind of change that mindset that I had. And so my question here is, given that context, what can we do to sort of change that mindset, especially as it pertains to serving multilingual learners and academic language learners in general?
Yeah, thanks for sharing that story. And I think that's not so dissimilar to many of us, whether we had formal teaching training or we felt like we were being thrown in there or not. I think, you know, there's sort of a cognitive dissonance, I think, that happens. I experienced that myself, and I talk about it in the book a little bit. Of for me, you know, as a white woman who represents over 70% of our nation's teaching force, being a teacher in an urban classroom, my first couple of years of students of color, language learner, multilingual learners, students with special education needs, and many situations that I could not relate to, Steve. So I think if we go to the sort of the way schools were designed they weren't really designed for the modern world. And we have to, you know, catch up to what our students need. So, you know, essentially those systems that you're talking about maybe are somewhat outdated, right? We've learned more about the brain. We've learned more about adult learning and psychological safety and what all learners need at every age to really develop agency and solve their own problems, not just give knowledge to the kids. That's not how, right, it needs to work. So sometimes we think back and we think, oh, that's how I was taught. And the other piece of that that I want to highlight is, as I gleaned on a minute ago, you know, our identity is so important. So if we were successful in school, and many teachers are, I identify as type A. I don't know about many of people in your audience.
Probably a lot.
You know, I mean, I'm recovering perfectionist over here. But, you know, I there were times in my career where I was very successful in school and I could do what it took. And then there were times in my teaching career or my learning career as a student where I was not successful. And those are the experiences that shape me the most is what was it like when I struggled as a learner? For all sorts of reasons that I also talk about in the book. And I think that's the piece. It's identity. And it's also updating the systems that we work in to support students.
Yeah, such a great point. I mean, we have so much in common. I mean, it was the same situation working in an urban school. And there were things like, okay, this worked for me, so it's going to work for everybody. This is like the American dream, right? Like my parents were immigrants, or my dad was an immigrant from Greece. And, you know, he had to drop out of high school, was drafted for Vietnam, the whole story, got a job at General Electric and was able to like raise a middle-class family in a affluent suburb, you know, bought a kind of shack there that we lived in so that we could live there and go to good schools in America. That's a terrible thing, right? That was depended very largely on your zip code, whether and what school you were in. And then I went and taught in the same district that he dropped out of. It was Lynn, Massachusetts, which you're probably familiar with, living where you live. And, you know, it was difficult, for me to understand the lived experience of all of my students and some of the ways that they were looking for support from me. I was really unable to provide the support that they needed because my lived experience was so, completely different. And I think like this is, I'm going to try to kind of abruptly transition into my next question, though I think there's a transition here. I think a lot of that was I was all alone. I was like thrown into this classroom and I learned so much from these students. I can still remember so clearly. And they were traumatized. It was a situation where the teacher had actually passed away in the middle of the school year. She's actually murdered. I don't think I've told the story in the podcast before. And so it was a huge thing. And so I came in 22 years old, like without any training, without understanding how this worked. I had students who were 2-3 years younger than me, realistically, who were seniors in high school. And I was just, it was just, okay, go for it. Like, and I was in this school and the support that I found was over time meeting other teachers on my own. So the transition that I'm making here is I was in a silo, as I'm sure in many ways you were too. And I'm sure a lot of teachers who are listening to this can relate to that. And that can be really sort of dangerous if we're in these silos, particularly with students who, with our multilingual learners and our students who come from varied backgrounds. So my question is, how do we go about this kind of like transition? And please feel free to like dive into any of the other topics I've just mentioned in this long question that I have. But how can we go about breaking down those silos to support all students? I mean, think about you when you were teaching or me in the situation that I just gave, particularly when we talk about, you know, what you framed as the language lens. How do we do that? What are some ways that we can make that happen?
Yeah. Well, first, I just want to say thanks for sharing that story as well, Steve. I mean, that is such an insightful trope, if you will, of what I think a lot of people experience. Bringing their own backgrounds in, having it shape our experiences as teachers, but also our experiences as learners. And then I love your family background too, of like your father maybe being maybe disenfranchised from the very same school that you were then teaching in. I mean, that's what a lot of our families go through. It's so multi-layered, right? So we've got to really lead with empathy. And I do believe that every teacher, you know, and I work with leaders all the way down to the classroom, but it really starts with the culture of the school. So seeing teachers as teacher leaders, I think you mentioned leading other teachers and kind of like cultivating a culture. So the organization that I run, Confianza, our mission is to improve cultural understanding, communication, and collaboration for the whole system. And that's really what it is, right? It's not just one teacher in one classroom, although we come across a lot of teachers who are taking one of our courses or reading their book on their own, but there's always an ask, how can you share what you're doing with other teachers? And likewise, leaders, how can you share what you're doing with other leaders? And when we work with the school, Steve, we always start with the general education leadership. So when we look at our data, it's about 75% of the folks that we work with in Confianza Services is general education. Mm-hmm. And of that, it's over 70% of the general education leaders. And then the rest is ELL, MLL staff and ELL, MLL leadership. Why do I say that? Because you talk about silos. Right. And it's so easy to be in a silo of, say, the ELL department or the special ed department or the speech and language department or whatever even department within a department you're in and have that specialty because you have a specialty. And that's important. We do need to recognize each other's expertise. At the same time, there's so much more that we have in common than not. And so the language lens really attempts to have an approach that's really about empathy-driven leadership, you know, in terms of leading your classroom as a teacher, and empathy-driven leadership in terms of developing that professional learning culture. So a lot of it that we talk about and that I talk about in the book is equity of voice. So whose voices are not being heard in the classroom? Whose voices are not being heard at the department level or mm-hmm. at the school level or at the district level? And so it's about really elevating all voices, right? As opposed to, well, this is, like we said before, this is the way things were done. So we're just going to replicate the way that we survived or thrived in school. And instead, you know, make sure that people in the margins who maybe have been historically underserved or underheard, make sure that they're in the center of the classroom and the school and district level as well.
Yeah, I love the connection that you're making, and I hear it frequently, between what we're trying to do with our students and what we're trying to do with our teachers and our staff in general, elevating all voices. Also love what you said about specialties and how they're important, but, you know, coming from the high school background, that can also be challenging because, you know, people want to be specialists in their content areas, and so it can be difficult to sort of bring everybody along on this journey. And then I'll say one more thing about before I get more into this, bringing everyone in and sort of facing what may appear to be a really daunting task. But I want to say one more thing about when teachers come together to support students. And I'm interested in your perspective on this because you're in districts all the time and you're trying to make this happen. And before we recorded this podcast, we were preparing probably a month ago, you and I were talking about how we'd like to talk about more than, I don't want to say just multilingual learners, but we want to really talk about the system. And that's something that I'm trying to do sort of in this podcast is not get into our little echo chamber and in our silo, because we're guilty of that too. And so that brings me to like my experience as a teacher in both districts I worked at. I worked in Lynn, Massachusetts, which is an urban school district, very similar to a lot of the districts that many of our listeners are working in. And then I worked in sort of an upper middle class suburban district that was very different demographically. What they both had in common were I found my people, the teachers that I worked with. It was an organic situation that we found each other, we sought each other out. We had this group of people who we thought we could support one another. We would walk into each other's rooms. I can remember a dear friend of mine still, who is a biology teacher and still teaching, would walk into my Spanish class and try to speak Spanish and really like not a very, she wasn't very good at it, right? But my students would love that. And it would build such great relationships. And I would walk into her class, she'd be doing a biology lab or whatever the case may be. Those organic relationships that formed are what our students remember and we see them still today, like some of these students that we had 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And they're what these students took with them, and they knew that they could rely on us because we were people. Mm-hmm. So what I'm getting at here, my question here is, that was organic. That just happened, right? It's lightning in a bottle. I've never experienced a situation where somebody came into our school or there was a system put in place and it just, it worked. So
right.
What is your observation? And I know that's a hard thing to do, right? And I don't think that's necessarily like exactly what you're trying to do, but I'm curious about that because I think people would be interested to hear, like, how do you create those cohorts, mm-hmm. break down silos and inspire people to work together in places where maybe they're just like in their classrooms and doing their own thing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great example. I mean, I think that's the question, right? How do you inspire internal change and how do you make it so, I like to look at it as how do you make it so it's an internal locus of control? I've done a lot of work before I started Confianza. I used to train for WIDA. I used to run, I mentioned before, a master's in ESL program. I worked in the nonprofit space with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation studying professional learning. And I'm really identify as a professional learning specialist more than I do any kind of instructional strategies, although
which is one of the reasons why I'm asking you this like extremely unfair question.
I love it. I'm like, let's get into it. All right. I'm a firm believer of it needs to be internal. So like you just described, that's a beautiful story of internal organic change. That's about collaboration and people working together. So the more that we can be behind the scenes when we work with the district, the better.
Yep.
And that's often not for everyone. Okay. And that's fine. So for example, you know, as Confianza is now entering our ninth year, we're able to really refine our model and say, well, we're happy to support you, but we'll consult with the leadership and do, you know, some coaching the coach work. So that those people who are building capacity of teachers and working on teacher teams and bringing teachers together are the ones getting the skills and guidance from us, not maybe us directly replacing them or mm-hmm. right, like being their surrogate, because that does not create sustainable systems. And we found that year and year after year. I mean, what we're doing is action research, Steve. We're helping practitioners do their own research. We're helping the leadership, you know, kind of bring in the tools and support that they need for just-in-time learning, which is really how adults learn, right? Not here's something that you should do. Here's a step-by-step program. It might be, you might need step two and step five. Mm-hmm. And let's check in on you on that. And we'll come in and support if you need implementation support, but we're not going to be able to do it for you because that's not how things work. And I've been there as a teacher, you know, I've been there, like you said, when people come in from outside, it's like, that's great. Again, we love expertise as educators. At the same time, how do we break down that cognitive dissonance to say, I can do it myself. We can do it together. And that's where we get into the strategies. So system-wide vision of equitable instruction for all learners, including multilingual learners. How do we have system-wide supports for educators? What is a professional learning community? What is an instructional coaching cycle? That's the stuff that we do. And that's really exciting because instead of teaching strategies for students, there's a lot of resources out there for that, including elevation strategies. Love that. It's more setting the conditions for that to happen, right? And then we bring in the strategies to support the instructional programming.
Yeah, I love what you said about setting the conditions. That's a big question and probably like 3 podcast episodes or more or a book. But I couldn't resist asking, and I love what you said about it. And I think that creating conditions is so important. You also mentioned all the other pieces that go into it. It's not just one solution and then you walk away and okay, we're ready for change. And I also think that there's a value in, and this is internal and this is hard right now, but hiring great teachers, you know, and developing them and finding ways to get people into the profession, which again, or the conversation for another time, but it's tricky.
I couldn't agree more if I can jump in there. I mean, I just touched on it in the book, and my background when I was last in a district was running the beginning teacher and mentoring program and developing instructional coaching systems.
I did that too. We
and
have so much in common.
Heart. Yeah. Oh, that's great. It breaks my heart when it's like, oh, a mentor is somebody who shows you where the copy machine is on Tuesday. It's like, no, it's like, no wonder why we're losing teachers. I mean, I was just hanging on and I had a wonderful support system and mentor. But yeah, I just want to touch if I can back on what we were saying about the system-wide pieces. I mean, as you said, it's multifaceted, but I want to bring this back to the language lens because here's what we see that happens. When we do walkthroughs and we work with leaders, Stephen, we try to see, okay, where is the breakdown? Why are we getting these student underperformance issues? We'll often see we don't have the professional learning structures tightened up. And then number two, we won't have that equity of voice in the classroom. So I mentioned that before, but it's really important to notice it and rely on real-time data. And that's my favorite thing to teach and to help is, how do you take real-time data? I'm not just talking about formative assessment. Did the students learn the content? It's, are they engaging through language? And you can measure that. And that's what we do. We help coaches do that. We help leaders do that, so that we're not just doing the big evaluation for teachers and replicating a proficiency-based system that doesn't show growth. We're actually measuring the nuances in real time to say, ooh, this group over here hasn't spoken at all. This group over here is highly engaged. By the way, whatever your role is as a teacher, your job is to teach, you know, speaking and writing, speaking and listening standards, for example, Massachusetts, we're talking about Massachusetts schools, but honestly, across the nation, right? Reading, writing, listening, speaking in every classroom isn't something that's an add-on. That's the language. Mm-hmm. We should be doing that anyways. So how do we help teachers see if they do that, more students will engage? And that's the piece that can be really unifying, because you're like, oh, hey, Steve, you did that? Oh, you did group roles? Cool. I'm going to try group roles and I'm across the hall from you. How did you do that?
That's organic piece that I was talking about earlier. Yep.
That's it.
But you have created a system to allow that to happen.
That's right.
Yeah. I want to get into that idea of an add-on. So you're talking about, you mentioned add-ons and how we want things to not appear like add-ons. I saw this all the time as a teacher. Obviously, I see this all the time at Elevation because it's the next tool. How long is this thing going to last? Like, do we really need to learn this? It's just going to change next year anyway. These are all very real, you know, perceptions and thoughts that teachers have, and they come from experience. So this whole language lens idea, I'm sure, can seem at first pretty daunting, particularly to the content teachers who I knew many of and were wonderful teachers, but they consider themselves, they consider themselves masters of their content areas for really their entire careers. These are veteran teachers who know their stuff, and that's a great thing. But when I look at like the list of skills and expertise that content teachers need to have, this is on page 29 of your book, it can be overwhelming. Just to read a few, like familiarity with students' linguistic and academic backgrounds, an understanding of the language demands that go along with learning tasks, the skills to implement appropriate scaffolding. So some of those we know, right? But some people will look at this. I can rattle off 10 names of teachers I worked with who will say immediately by the way, this is a very devil's advocate question that I'm giving you right now.
Bring it on.
But so people will look at this, they'll say familiarity with students' linguistic and academic backgrounds. As soon as they see linguistic and even academic, they're like, well, how do I know that? This kid just got here and I don't know any of that. No, I'm the science teacher, right? So we talked a little bit about this, but that initial resistance to that kind of change that will be helpful over time can be really like crippling for people. So what advice would you give? And you can certainly answer this by talking about what you do, but what advice would you give or recommendations would you give to those of us who are trying to convince those folks to come along with us? Because they're great teachers and they have a tremendous amount to offer, but they're crippled by this anxiety of how am I supposed to do this and everything else, to your point of add-ons.
Yeah, great question. And I think it goes back to, I keep saying it, but that cognitive dissonance, that psychological.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of psychological safety, sort of, right? You're like, I can't do it. I don't know what that means. I thought I was a good teacher. It's like, I've been there. I've been that teacher, which, you know, is one of the reasons why I do what I do. I don't think you should have to have an ESL license to work effectively with multilingual learners in a general education classroom. And I think that can mean a couple of different things. It can mean that's a lot of pressure on the content teachers. It presents like a lot of pressure. And at the same time, it can sometimes abscond the responsibility from the EL teacher. We actually need them to work together. We need the ML staff to work with the general education staff instead of saying, which happened to me a lot when I was an EL teacher, take these kids, they're your kids. You work with over here and do your magic language stuff. And I'm going to go over here and do my content stuff. And it's
sounds
like,
familiar.
That didn't work. Like, it sort of worked to ease the teacher's anxiety, the general education teacher's anxiety. But I could see that my students weren't able to connect the dots when I was in that position as an EL teacher. And so I like to actually call them language specialists and content specialists, even though ESL is its own content area. all that to say, I'm getting back to the question, which is how do we break down that effective filter, if you will, that like the barrier of, I don't know what linguistic means. I'm a teacher. You say, you already do that. You teach tier three vocabulary. Let me teach you what that means. It's the content specific vocabulary of your, again, biology class. You're teaching mitosis, for example. Great. Kids got that correct on a vocabulary test. How many of them got it correct or can tell you what it means in their own words?
Right.
How many of them can transfer that to something different? Did it really stick? And I'm not saying that that's not the case. There are a lot of teachers that teach in some modalities that aren't maybe as modern that are getting great results. I'm not saying this is the case in all classrooms. I'm just saying if we sit with kids, and this is what coaches and leaders can do, go into a classroom, you know, sit with the kid quietly. What are you learning about? Can you explain it to me? Mitosis, or worse yet, chapter three, right? What are you learning? Not just what page are you reading? What's the topic? Why are you learning it? Can you explain it? And that's, I'm talking about academic language learners at this point, all language learners. How can they represent their learning so that they're owning it? Ultimately, we want students to be their own teachers. And if that's the case, I mean, that's my belief. And if that's the case, it shouldn't just be regurgitation of knowledge once again. So sometimes we'll find that content teachers' anxiety is not, I can't help multilingual learners, but when we really look deeper at the data, I'm talking the qualitative data and quantitative, we see, I actually, as a teacher, I maybe don't feel comfortable with reaching a lot of my students.
Yeah.
So again, let's start there. Are they reading below grade level? You talk about high school. It's one of our biggest groups that we work with. If you look at the Lexile levels, and I'll put my reading specialist hat on here for a second, because I'm a reading specialist too, is you look at the Lexile levels of students, say in your ninth grade bio class, and they might be at a third, fourth, seventh, eighth grade reading level. So we've got to do things differently, Steve. And it's not just for our multilingual learners, because they need special skills from their English learner teachers, ML teachers. But again, can we redesign, or not rehaul, but sort of tweak?
Yeah.
Just put the lens on it and say, let's get kids talking more. Let's get kids writing more. Let's use sentence stems for kids who need it. And kids who don't, they can have more. And just really make sure that the classroom is language rich, because chances are all kids are not performing to their potential already. So if we help teachers see that in a psychologically safe way, not a threatening way, not it's punitive, this is not evaluative, we're helping you, we're helping each other. What are other science teachers doing to maybe help bridge that gap? Right. Start to see, well, maybe there's something deeper going on with that teacher that's not just about the multilingual learners. Because again, there's so much intersectionality between different types of students that it doesn't really help to just silo them. We have a lot of similar issues around literacy, for example, and oral language in our classrooms.
You bring up a really, really great point. And like this way of looking at things, I feel like we've scraped the surface of it, or we've kind of like been around the edges of it. But the way that you just explained that over the last 2 to 3 minutes, I feel like is worth listening to again, if you didn't, or you zoned out during that part, or you need to hear, because it's kind of going back to the systemic. This is a system. We are not siloing students. We're not siloing teachers. We want to do better for everybody. And we can do better at the things that we want to do better at. And that also supports our multilingual learners and our academic language learners. You know, in my mind is this idea of going from a weekly vocabulary test, mitosis, meiosis, whatever the case may be, to, you know, more project-based stuff, or more, you know, presentation, whatever the case may be, in order to demonstrate knowledge and to really own and master that knowledge. And I love the idea of students being their own teachers and being able to teach others what they're talking about. And it's exactly what you said. That sort of takes away that cognitive dissonance, or lowers that effective filter for both teachers and students. And so I just really appreciate the way you just explained that. I think it's one of those things. It seems so simple when you say it the way that you did, but it, you know, I don't know. I just haven't heard it expressed quite in that way. So appreciate that.
Sure.
All right. I'm going to try to ask sort of two questions in one here, because there's a lot that I want to get to, but I also don't want this to go on for too long for those who are listening. So there are two things that I'm really interested in getting at here. One is the idea that teachers need to be comfortable with themselves, and they need to know who they are as people, as teachers, et cetera, their own identities, in order to best serve their students. Not something that when I was in a teacher, I ever even feel like I heard about. And that's really sad, but that's the case. And then I think one of the kind of solutions that you provide is in the book, the language lens self-assessment. So tying those things together, if in fact I can tie them together, you tell me. What do we need to do to make sure that teachers understand who they are and what they bring? And how does or does that language lens self-assessment kind of get to that? So it's a way of kind of starting out that journey.
Yeah, sure. I mean, like we said earlier, Steve, you know, we often teach the way we were taught, and that's a natural human reaction. I'm sure it's true for parents, you know, and anyone that's kind of bringing people up in the world. As teachers, it's important that we try to, when I say teachers, I'm going to extend that to all educators, right? Because I'm talking about support staff, school psychologists. I mean, I'm really talking about principals for kind of everybody as educators. So let me use that term. As educators, it's really important to realize that the social location that we have is often not the same as what we're teaching. And what do I mean by social location? So I'll use myself as an example, and I do that in the book too, right? I mentioned before, I'm a white woman. I was born into an English speaking family. I was a free lunch kid. I experienced some of that stigmatization as a child. But primarily, right, I'm in a position of having more opportunity because of my demographics. You mentioned that earlier, demographics, you know, zip code should not be your destiny. Demographics should not be your destiny, but it often is. So we have to be aware of that. There isn't a one size fits all. And so if we as educators examine our own social identity, our own social location in response to our students, we can then see, okay, I might be a mirror for my students. In other words, I might reflect some of them and their lived experiences, but I might be a window, which, you know, is really a way to look at new perspectives. Or in between, I might be, you know, a sliding glass door, which is I might represent some of what students have gone through. Like, for example, with my experiences growing up in lower socioeconomic status in my early years, that's something that some of my students can relate to. When I was in the classroom, however, right, teaching students of color, that's a different part of my identity that I don't have in common. And so to not, you know, really whitewash that is really important. And I know it can get political. You know, I've got my master's in social justice education over 20 years ago. I've seen, you know, the tides ebb and flow here. And so I'm not trying to preach a political viewpoint. I want to make that perfectly clear. I'm talking about caring for children. That's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about making sure, as a precondition for learning, which is a research-based, brain-based, essential component of any classroom, is making sure that children feel safe.
Right.
And children feel safe when they know that we care about them and that we understand a little bit, at least, or we try to understand that they have their own story and it's not necessarily the same as ours, right? So that creates a sense of safety, essentially. Otherwise, right, again, we're just kind of replicating what we talked about at the top, that standardized model, the industrialized, you know, how schools were originally formed model, which is stamping kids out and going by the bell and more factory-based, when that's just not appropriate anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, we go back to like where we started, which is, you know, we have to think about how schools were designed and how we were taught and who we are as people, as educators, and really kind of do an inventory check, figure out like where we are, where we're coming from, what we can offer, and probably just as importantly, what we can learn from the students and our colleagues as well. I think that's really, really important.
Yeah. So let me answer the second part of your question, because you brought back to the inventory. Thanks.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the piece around, you know, who we are and how we always have something to learn. I am fairly transparent about this in my work. I don't even like the term expert or consultant when people label me that. I'm like, we're all collaborating. We're all collaborating and we're all sharing expertise. And so it's important to model that from the leadership level on down. I can't stress that enough. And I just wrote a piece for Language Magazine, and it's on our website too at ELL students in the article section about leaders modeling that change. So being risk takers, saying, I don't know this. Mm-hmm. This is new to me. Or we've never had students from, we've never had Somali students, for example. Like, we need to figure that out, and I'm going to help. And I'm not just going to abscond that to the ML department. I'm going to figure that out as the superintendent. I'm going to work with you as the principal. Like, I'm going to own that, and I'm going to be vulnerable in front of my staff. And that trickles down, right? So we talked about that before, Steve. The parallel practices is what I like to call it. From the leadership on down, or fractals, from the classroom on up. How can we help students take risks? Well, we've got to take risks as teachers or anyone that's caring and educating students. We've got to be able to say, I need to do better all the time. So one of the tools in the book at the end of chapter one is the language lens self-assessment. And it's a very simple way to start. And we do have it available too publicly if people are interested to get that. But it's a starting point for that. And it's designed for all educators, Steve. So whatever role you have, you know, this piece about identity, there's a piece about different ways of honoring language and literacy in the classroom. And that's really, you know, I think that's the starting point for all of us to model that inquiry so that our students can then take risks and be their best selves.
Yeah, I find tools like that. And I you know, I've seen yours in the book, and it's great to know it's publicly available. Maybe we can link to it. I find tools like that, simple tools like that, to be really effective to start that journey. And just to remind people that, hey, this is something that we need to do, because you're so invested in at the beginning of the school year, and you got to get to know your students, and you got to get everything ready, and you kind of forget about yourself and your own lived experience because it's just with you all the time. It's not something that you really, or I'll just speak for myself, it's something I really think about. And every time I do, whether it's I'm in a therapy session or I'm having a really vulnerable conversation with someone, I remember, wow, like this is like really important stuff. And I just forget about it because I live with myself and my identity all the time, go out into the world and do my thing and don't reflect on it often enough. So whatever we can do to provide those simple tools, I think is valuable.
Yeah, thanks for recognizing that. And I think too, it's a moment of realizing if I speak English proficiently and if I present in the world as an able-bodied, et cetera, person that might be more advantaged in a situation, that's easier to forget about sometimes for us. Yeah. I mean, I have to remind myself constantly, you know, of the opportunities that I have, and that's important, right? So sitting and listening and talking to families and talking to people who don't have the same experiences and hearing their stories, that's data. So we talked about data. I mean, I'll say like data is not a four-letter word. People often feel like it is. I like to say data is not a four-letter word because data is stories. Data is just what you said, like, here's what I experienced.
Yeah.
How do I do that? And I also want to say, I really appreciate what you just hit on about that rub that especially beginning teachers feel, but really I think a lot of educators, if not all educators, of like, I'm spending 80 hours a week. You know, the research says beginning teachers are spending over 70 hours a week all year, right? Yeah. I know I did. How do I take care of myself and how do I take care of the students? That's a major area that we need to work on.
Yeah, for sure.
I'll just say it, right? I mean, when I had my school custodian, you know, knock on my classroom at 8 p.m. my first year of teaching and say, Sarah, let's go shoot some hoops in the gym, take a break.
Yeah.
You know, I knew like, well, but there's still more work to do. So again, how do we support teachers and how do we make sure that people are not just martyring themselves?
Yes.
For their students, it's really a tricky thing. And I think there's a lot more work to do there. And I don't have those. I definitely do not have those answers yet.
Yeah, there's so much work. And it's not just on us, it's on the rest of our society to not have this martyrdom syndrome that you just talked about. And, you know, when you go to a cocktail party or whatever the case may be, and you say, these are the memories that I have, so many cherished memories of teaching, but this is the one that I don't cherish and I wish I could forget. You know, you'd go to a party and people would ask what you did. And I'd say, oh, I'm a teacher. And they'd say, oh, good for you. What an amazing thing. And it was always this, like, I don't know how to describe it. It was never came from the right place. And it wasn't even those people's fault. It's just, that's how society has portrayed our society, educators, as martyrs. And the idea is, yeah, of course they work 70, 80 hours a week because they have to. It's our kids. Why would they not? tough one. And again, fodder for another conversation in the future.
Yeah. As an edupreneur, I identify with everything you just said.
Yeah. Yep. I get it. All right. Well, I'm gonna wrap it up there, because otherwise we could definitely go for another hour. Maybe we can definitely let's find another time, maybe in the next season to catch up and talk more about this. In the meantime, two more questions. One is, how can people learn more about the work you're doing? We'll link to whatever you have available so folks can find out more.
Sure. I mean, I would definitely send people, if you're listening or you get to the link, is languagelens.com. It's a new URL that we created just for all this stuff that we're talking about. The book is there. The free resources are linked there. Other interviews, quotes from leaders. And then there's that's my personal website, which is at sarahotto.com. And you're going to see other opportunities there. We're also launching a Language Lens Academy later this year, which will be able to provide that model that I talked about to you, Steve, of coaching coaches and coaching leaders and kind of being the behind the scenes toolkit and guidance. My organization is called Confianza. So you can always go to ellstudents.com. The sites link to each other, so you'll be back and forth if you're exploring them. And ellstudents.com is where you can find us, Confianza courses and the articles I mentioned. And by the way, Steve, ELL, we talk about ELL students, and that's why I named the website ELL Students, not for English language learners, but for our whole vision at Confianza, which is equity, language, and literacy. Yeah. So it's about what we do as educators. So that's a little fun tip. For folks, if you haven't joined us, sign up for the newsletters, you know, stay connected. We do share a lot of our resources with Steve's team, which is wonderful. And I am also featured in the instructional strategies toolkit, which is exciting too. So some nice intersections there.
Yeah. I love the collaboration. We were saying beforehand, a lot of the articles that you write, we also share in our community brief as well. So folks, most of the people who listen to this are probably getting that. And you'll find a blog post for this episode as well on our community, elevationeducation.com/ELcommunity. If you haven't signed up for that yet, go ahead and sign up, and then you'll get that brief that I was talking about. And I will just put another plug in for the book. I really, really like the way that it's written. I think it is a great guidebook, but it's also not like a textbook, if that makes sense. It's just really easy to go through. So highly recommend that.
Thanks.
Go ahead, please.
I just want to say, you know, I appreciate that. And I want to say, as I'm admiring your microphone here on the Zoom call that we're recording this podcast in, I did want to say I'm supposed to talk about my audiobook. So before we go any further,
yeah,
I did just finish recording the audiobook version, which, by the way, was a very interesting experience, because reading what you write is different than speaking off the cuff, right? Or presenting or teaching. So I was privy to use incredible audio equipment like what you have in a professional studio. And that will be coming out later this fall as well, too. So you can learn about that at thelanguagelens.com.
That's a little bit on my bucket list, is to record an audio book, not my own, because I don't see myself writing a book anytime soon. So if you ever see an opportunity for that, please let me know. I would love to even just do a chapter. I just think that'd be so much fun. I think a lot of people are probably pretty horrified by it, but maybe it's just the podcast.
I haven't done that. You have a very good like voice actor. You could really check out voice acting because you have so much extra time.
I have tons of time. Yeah. Yeah, between my job, my own children, and everything else, it's fine. But no, we'll see. Anyway, maybe that'll be a retirement pursuit for me whenever that time comes.
I can see it.
Speaking of books and audiobooks and other resources, I have one more question for you that we ask everybody. I asked you this probably 3 years ago, and I don't remember what your answer was. But is there currently a book or a film or any other resource that's kind of having an important influence on you, either personally or professionally, that you'd want to recommend to listeners?
I mean, I had to think long and hard about this, and so I'm going to keep it really short and sweet because I could go on and on about this too. But I recently finished The Kitchen House, and it's historical fiction. I love historical fiction. Great way to learn about other stories and history. And I highly recommend that one for people who would like to get an inside view into the lives of enslaved people, different backgrounds of enslaved people in this country, in the South. And it's just really quite the story. So at any rate, that's what I've got for you today, Steve.
Excellent. The Kitchen House. It is now on my list. And selfishly, one of the reasons why I ask is because I get new book recommendations as well. But it benefits everybody, I hope. Okay, well, Sarah Otto, the book is The Language Lens for Content Classrooms, a guidebook for teachers, coaches, and leaders, second edition. Really well worth checking out. We'll link to all of the resources that you put in. And I really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for joining us, and we'll do it again.
Thanks so much, Steve. It was great.
Thanks for listening to Highest Aspirations. If you liked our show, please be sure to join the ELL community at elevationeducation.com/ELL community, where you'll find all the episodes of Highest Aspirations and other resources to help educators maximize the impact on their English language learners. Also, let us know how we're doing by writing a review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.